This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Catherine Cullen, and this is The House.
From now on, I identify as a paper straw because nobody wants me. I'm terrible at my job, and I can't function for longer than 5 minutes without completely breaking down. Thank y'all.
As that TikToker points out, a lot of people think paper straws suck. But plastic pollution is a major scourge all over the world. So today on The House, how do we fix the plastic problem? Is there a less soggy path forward that can still curb plastic waste? We'll head to a UN conference to hear how your recycling box and grocery store might soon get a shakeup. Plus, another big part of the green shift.
This is historic. It's the largest auto investment in Canadian history.
As a great Canadian once said, that is where the puck is going, and that is where we're going to be.
Honda is investing $15 billion in EVs and batteries in Canada. But why is the company going big at a time when electric car sales are softening? The CEO of Honda Canada on the challenges of selling EVs right now, and the industry minister on whether all the jobs from this deal will go to Canadians. So, start your engines. The House is now in session. Honda's major $15 billion investment has a lot of pieces to it. An EV car plant, a new standalone EV battery plant, and two plants that will build battery parts. To land the deal, there are tax dollars involved. Honda gets $2.5 billion from the federal government in tax credits and another $2.5 billion from the province of Ontario through what it calls direct and indirect investment. If you've been keeping tabs, the total federal spending on EVs now adds up to $46 billion. So, how does the government justify all that spending? François-Philippe Champagne is the Federal Industry and Innovation Minister. I spoke with him earlier. Minister, welcome back to the House.
It's great to be with you today.
This is an estimated $2.5 billion in tax credits to Honda on top of other multi-billion dollar deals with Stellantis, Volkswagen, Northvolt. It's coming at a time when, as you know, a lot of Canadians are struggling and your government is raising taxes through capital gains on other corporations. Why keep spending on this?
Well, I would say investing. Because if you were with the workers here, they understand that if you want to create prosperity, you need to invest. I mean, Canadians listening to us know that. They know that if they want to generate revenues, they have to invest. I think this is a down payment in our future. You're talking about the largest single investment in the auto industry in Canadian history. You're talking about the largest investment of Honda in 75 years history. Listen, we're putting the auto sector on a trajectory for success for generations. And I'll tell you, there's also a cost of inaction. You know, when I came in office, some people in the industry were talking about the end of the auto sector that would follow like the United Kingdom, Australia. And I must say, kudos to our workers. We've turned that around in a way which very few in the world would believe. Even now, Bloomberg is ranking us first in the world for the battery ecosystem, ahead of China. I think as Canadians, we have the right to tap each other on the shoulder and say, well done, because you know what? We're creating prosperity for generations to come. And I think that's the way we need to build a strong country.
There is still a talk to some extent of another deal, right? This question of Toyota kind of hanging out there. Are there billions more in tax credits on the table if another big player wants to set up in Canada?
Well, you know me, I talk to everyone. We've talked to American auto manufacturers. We brought Volkswagen the first time. Listen, Catherine, the first time I went in Germany, people were smiling and say, Minister, they've never considered Canada. And I said, well, if we only talk to people who have already invested, we're not going to get new investments. So Volkswagen was a great example of bringing European manufacturers. Now with Honda, I think it sends a message to the world. And I can tell you, my phone is ringing, that people are saying, wow, if it's good for Volkswagen, if it's good for Honda, if it's good for GM and Ford and Stellantis, this is the place to be because we're building a green manufacturing hub for electric vehicles. So obviously, I'm going to keep talking to everyone. But let me just clarify something. When people say there's tax credits, I mean, the way you win these investments is about the people. It's really, I was there with the chairman, believe it or not, 2 years ago.
The tax credits play a role, though. Surely they help, sir. You wouldn't be offering them up.
They help, but I would tell you, go to the interview that when we announced Volkswagen, and there was a question from the press to Oliver, the CEO of Volkswagen. They say, Minister, not Minister, he said, sir, you came to Canada for the subsidy, and you started with a smile. He said, well, listen, the government is giving me at best 3 years of subsidies and I'm here for a century. So that means I have to be on my own for 97 years. We came here because of the people, the stability, the predictability you find in Canada, the critical mineral, renewable energy.
Okay.
So I think you have to see it in not only today, but over the next decade and over the next century. You're building for the next century. Very, very rarely you can have things like that where you say we're building now jobs, not only for today, but you know, the people at the plant, they were telling us, Minister, our kids and grandkids will be able to work here and have a good life.
That's exactly what I want to ask you about, in fact, Minister. Did you negotiate any conditions with Honda to ensure that all of these jobs are going to go to Canadian workers?
Well, Honda has a great reputation in Canada. You should have heard the mayor of New Tecumseh, who is the mayor here, and he said they're an amazing corporate citizen. So obviously, we always look to maximize Canadian jobs. They already have 5,000 jobs. You're talking about four additional plants. You're going to have what we call a cathode plants. You're going to have a EV plant. You're going to have a battery plant. And there's another joint venture in the making. This is four plants. This is thousands of jobs. And if you look at the ecosystem, this is tens of thousands of jobs, not only for today, but for generations to come. And you know, when you anchor them in Canada, we all win. This is not only for Alliston, but it's for Ontario and for the country.
You'll know, Minister, that I'm asking because Canada's Building and Trades Union has said another project getting government subsidies, the NextStar plant, is seeing foreign workers doing jobs that were promised to Canadian workers. So not just showing them what to do, but actually taking away jobs is the allegation. Do you have it in writing that that kind of thing is not going to happen at these Honda facilities?
Well, I refer you to their latest comment, were far more positive. You know, they know that we've been fighting at every step of the way. I spoke myself to the CEO of the joint venture. I spoke to the CEO of Stellantis for North America. Everyone understands we need to maximize jobs. But just to put things in perspective, you're talking about, 72 workers out of about 2,000 on the construction sites today and 5,000 jobs to be created. I think that people who look at that understand that we're building and Canadians are winning. And obviously, we're going to be pushing at every step of the way to maximize the number of Canadian jobs. That's what we do every day. And that's what we'll continue to do, obviously.
So I just want to be crystal clear. It sounds like you're saying, no, we don't have it in writing, but fundamentally, there's just not a lot of jobs that this would necessarily
affect.
Well,
we always have undertakings to maximize Canadian jobs in what we do. But Canadians also understand that sometime you need to bring specialized workers in order to install some type of machinery and equipment. And this is not new. You know, we have a very, very long established, way of building plants in North America. So, Canadians understand that. We've been doing these things for a long, long time. The auto sector is used. We've been helping to build plants in the U.S. Some Americans have come here to help us. I mean, this is how these things. But let's not just focus on today. Let's think that we're building the future now for this year, the next decade, and the next century.
You are also beefing up the semiconductor corridor. I wonder, do you envision Canada and the U.S., this corridor, becoming the big player in the world and dethroning Taiwan? Is that where the aim is here?
Well, listen, this is a tall order, but I'll tell you, when I started with battery plants, we had zero. And now we have, four or five and counting. So what we want to do, you may recall when President Biden came to the House of Commons, he made a very powerful statement. What I've been trying to talk to our American friends was to say one of the most relevant economic corridor that exists in the world is the Windsor and Detroit corridor. That's one of the largest corridor to manufacture car. And I said, why don't we take that as an example to do the same thing with semiconductors? Because we know that, semiconductors are going to be essential for the industrial revolution we're seeing today, but also for the digitalization of the economy, talking about AI and quantum. So the corridor, which we call Albany to Bromont in Quebec, is going to be a key cornerstone of that. And I always say to my American friends, economic security is national security. And that's something they understand well. So obviously, the announcement we made is building that corridor, very, very key, because you may know or not, but about 80% of all the semiconductors which are manufactured in the United States today are packaged and tested in Canada, actually. So my message to our American friends, well, whilst you're increasing production, we need on the Canadian side to increase the testing and packaging capacity, because otherwise we're not going to be as resilient as we want. And we know that resiliency when it comes to semiconductors is key. So, you know, this is a big week for Canada. On one end, we're becoming the EV manufacturing hub. On the other end, we've positioned ourselves to be a key component in the strategic supply chain for semiconductors in North America. So, you know, it's a big week for Canada and Canadian workers.
Okay. I do want to ask you about a tech issue, although a little bit of a different one. The United States passed legislation this week that gives ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, two options: sell TikTok or it will be banned. Would the Canadian government ever consider following the U.S.'s lead, banning TikTok here?
Well, we're looking at what they're doing on the U.S. side very carefully. You know, we were ahead of the curve again. You know, Canada started the national security review before even there was talks in the United States with respect to looking at TikTok. This review is still ongoing because it involves national security, as you would appreciate. I'm not at liberty to expend very much on that.
Sorry, Minister, but you make that point about the review. It's been going for a while. Can we expect results soon?
Well, yeah, but when you talk national security, I don't think people are saying it needs to be done quickly. It needs to be right. I think when you talk national security, you don't want to cut corner. This is like you said, there are millions of users. But what I want to reassure parents is that we're looking into that very seriously with all the agencies we have, from the intelligence community, talking to our U.S. friends. And our mission is to make sure that, you know, we do what's right for Canadians. And so that's what we're doing currently.
Do you welcome the move by the United States, though? It has potential to be a bit of a game changer.
Well, listen, like I said, we're really looking at what they did. We're going to be having our officials will certainly have discussions with them on the intelligence side to understand a number of things, you know, so that whatever decision we take will be in the best interest of Canadians to protect them. That's what we did also on AI. You know, that's why we've always said if we want to move from fear to opportunity, we need to build trust. To do that, we need rules. And I think the move by the United States is framing that discussion. So we're going to be following that very carefully.
Thank you very much for your time today, Minister.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne. Now, Honda's investment comes as the market for EVs is slowing down. So is this bet on Canada the right move? And what will it take to get more people to buy EVs? Jean-Marc Leclerc is president and CEO of Honda Canada. I asked him if it was the federal government's tax credits that were the tipping point to make Honda choose Canada.
Of course, that played a role. Canada has to compete against other jurisdictions as companies make their play on the electrification front, really looking globally at some of the options. And I think they've come with an approach, I think, that it was appealing to Honda to move our plan forward.
We talked to Minister Champagne. He just told us that the government wants to maximize Canadian jobs. Did Honda Canada make any guarantees that the jobs created by these facilities will be filled by Canadian workers?
Yeah, our number one objective is to optimize Canadian jobs. There's absolutely no doubt about that. One of the big challenges was taking on such a massive undertaking is obviously the availability of those jobs, of those trades, if you will, to make this happen within the timelines that we have to meet, basically, because there's consequences of missing deadlines. And again, we need to bring these vehicles to market to adhere to the EV mandate in Canada. What I've done is I've taken the proactive approach to reach out to my counterpart, the executive director of the Canadian Building and Trade Association, last week, and to have a conversation as to how we can make that happen. How do we optimize good paying Canadian job in the process of building what we want to build in this country? We had an excellent conversation. We talked about establishing a memorandum of understanding that we're currently working on, and basically sitting at the table. And the more we communicate with them to say, here are the timeline, here are the number of people we will need to make this happen, we will get to a very good place, I'm very confident. But the important thing is that we're talking, and again, the objective being to optimize Canadian jobs.
I want to zoom out and talk about the big picture around electric vehicles right now. Ford said it was delaying the start of its electric vehicle production in Canada by 2 years. Tesla's losing money. What do you think it is that's going on in the market right now?
Well, I can tell you with our project, our view, our operating assumption is really about 2028 and beyond. That's when our first EV is going to roll off the new EV plant in Alliston. And in the end, what we're seeing right now is a matter of the conditions not be optimal for mass adoption for Canadians. So we're working with government, we're working with stakeholders.
What does that mean? Like, what are you talking about? Like, are we talking charging stations or?
Charging station. I think there's work to be done on affordability, things of the sort, solutions for what we call garage orphans, people that, you know, live in condos and apartment buildings in Canada, which represent roughly 35% of the population. So mass adoption really means finding solutions to eliminate people's anxieties about owning an EV today. Obviously, there's a window for that to happen. We're asking, again, all stakeholders involved to work to make sure that those conditions are in place. We as an auto industry don't control all these aspects for success. We can bring vehicles to market. We have to sell them. People have to be comfortable buying them. And a lot of it depends on some of the pieces of that puzzle coming together in a very, tight period of time.
You say stakeholders, but I mean, do you mean governments fundamentally? Like, you want more charging stations? This has to do with electricity capacity. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so obviously governments play a big role in terms of supporting those companies. For example, we're talking charging stations to, again, what I call being ahead of the curve, because with the influx of EVs coming to market, you know, people need to have a very good experience with them. And that includes public charging stations being not only more of them, but the reliability sort of improving, which has been a little bit of an issue. So, and of course, these companies need to work a little faster, if you will, on that front to, again, stay ahead of the curve of the number of EVs coming to market. So while there's a slowdown, I think it's important for people to realize there's going to be more EVs available in the next few years, probably double the number of what we have today, because the industry needs to comply to, again, the government mandates federally and also in certain provinces. That really accelerates, you know, the manner in which we need to bring them to market and sell them to consumers.
I can imagine someone who is listening to this and they're thinking, okay, Honda just got $5 billion combination of tax credits and subsidies provincially. And here you are saying, well, governments also need to invest more in charging stations and all these other pieces. Saying, you know, how can industry keep asking for so much government money here? What would you say?
Well, I think, you need to start at the very beginning, is that we're trying to address, obviously, environmental concerns, climate change. Governments are taking certain actions to accelerate these developments and those investments in a very short period of time. And with that needs to come all the other components of that ecosystem to come together to make sure that that ultimate objective gets realized. So it's not just investing, for example, in auto plants and bringing those investments to Canada, because, again, we're competing against the world and mostly against our colleagues to the south. You know, it's all sort of pieces of that puzzle that need to come together to achieve that ultimate objective. So I think, yes, the government need to, I think, play a role in coordinating those activities and ensuring that they happen for their policy to be successful, but also for the companies that do invest also to be successful towards that objective.
When we talk about objectives, the government wants to end the sale of gas-powered vehicles by 2035, 11 years from now.
Yep.
Is that a realistic goal?
Well, it's a complicated question. In many respects, because a lot of it speaks to all the things that I've mentioned so far about creating those right conditions for people to transition. EVs have a lot of advantages. We need to make them more affordable. There's obviously benefits for people about reducing what they pay for gas, you know, for their mobility. But when you're looking at the entire population eventually transitioning, it will definitely take time, and a lot needs to happen to appeal to everybody in the marketplace. So it's a difficult question that we don't know. There's so many other factors happening in Canada. For example, we're talking about the housing crisis, the pressure on individuals to afford housing, and so on and so forth. So again, what is the impact on the average Canadian's situation, if you will, when we're introducing a way, at least in the short term, certainly a little bit more expensive to transition to EVs? So it really has to do with how this will evolve over time. And again, the affordability issue will need to be resolved, and it will be resolved through technology. It will be resolved through investments like we're making to try to build plants that are focused on EV manufacturing that will lower the cost and hopefully be price parity two internal combustion engines we sell today.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
You're most welcome.
Jean-Marc Leclerc is president and CEO of Honda Canada. I'm Catherine Cullen, and you're listening to The House from CBC Radio. You want to talk divisive, hot-button issues? Ask about straws. Case in point, debate last week in the House of Commons.
Soggy, limp, wet, and utterly useless. No, Deputy Speaker, we're not talking about the Liberals. We're talking about paper straws.
I understand that they're inconvenient, but my goodness, let's really talk about the issue at hand here. The issue at hand is that we have plastic pollution that is destroying our marine ecosystems, that is destroying the health and well-being of people across the country.
People here in this house, every day they're drinking orange juice from a plastic container. Is it toxic? No, it's not. They're eating their yogurt in the lobby from plastic. Is it toxic? No, it's not.
That was Conservative MP Marilyn Gladue, NDP MP Lisa Marie Baron, and Conservative MP Corey Tucker. They're talking about a Conservative push to take plastics off the Canadian Environmental Protection Act's list of toxic substances so they can bring back plastic straws. While some are battling for plastics, this week 4,000 people descended on Ottawa for a global effort to stop plastic pollution. Think of the Paris Treaty to limit carbon emissions. Well, this is basically Paris for plastics, aka the fourth session of the United Nations Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution. We went over to check it out and meet scientists and activists fighting for change, people in industry trying to figure out what a lower plastic future looks like, and the deal makers aiming to turn all this debate into an agreement. So, can the world do it? Let's start by looking at how plastic is affecting the planet right now.
This is my first time in Canada, yes.
And it's April, but you still got some snow.
And it's very, very different compared to the weather, the tropical weather back in Fiji.
Rufino Veria studies marine ecotoxicology at the University of the South Pacific. He's part of the Scientists' Coalition for an Effective Plastics Treaty, a group of independent scientists from around the world who are supporting negotiators as this treaty is hammered out.
We are on the receiving end of plastic pollution. For Fiji, and like many other Pacific Island countries, one of the appalling and disappointing sights for a country that is remote, that is supposedly supposed to be, you know, a pristine paradise. What we have are landfills, vast landfills that are already at capacity. And many of these landfills are located along the coastal areas near indigenous communities where sea level rise is causing most of these plastics to enter the ocean. And we also have legacy plastics, plastics that are produced elsewhere, yet making its way into our ecosystems from outside of Fiji, into our ecosystems, and exacerbating the problem. So we have the external threats and the internal threats of plastic pollution. And that's really saddening.
Marian Ledesma is a zero-waste campaigner at Greenpeace Philippines.
It's not just a matter of plastic waste now. It's so much more than that. There are other issues as well, as burning of the plastic waste in cement kilns is one waste management practice that actually creates a lot of health issues in surrounding communities. When you're burning plastics, you're releasing all of these toxic emissions. So that's one thing. Another is that we're seeing microplastics in our seafood. And there have been studies conducted in Metro Manila, our capital, where they've found microplastics in the air. I think one other aspect that sometimes gets overlooked is also waste colonialism. So when countries ship their waste to developing nations, the Philippines is one of those recipient countries, unfortunately.
Waste can end up on Canadian shores, too.
It's crucial, this conversation, for us as Inuit who live in the Arctic. I'm Lisa Khiloki Khopikwaluk, and I'm the president for Inuit Circumpolar Council of Canada, which also makes me vice chair to Inuit Circumpolar Council.
She explains that Inuit governments have been studying the presence of plastics in marine mammals and birds.
The intrusion of plastics into the Arctic waters is from somewhere else. It doesn't come from our communities. Some does, for sure, like there are lost fishing nets, but it's the impact of the movement of the oceans and the currents in the globe that bring plastics from different parts of the world. It could come from Europe, the areas across the Bering Strait, to Alaska. And if they are microplastics or even tiny, tiny, tiny nanoplastics that are ingested by plankton, that is a food source of, let's say, fish and whales and so on, well, then they enter into the bodies of whales, beluga, and fish, the Arctic char, salmon, seals, those animals that we consider our healthy food, our healthy and happy food in our communities. So that's where the major concern is from.
All of those concerns are fueling the talks taking place in Ottawa. This is the fourth of five rounds, with the last one scheduled for South Korea in November. The Canadian government has taken a strong stand. In addition to hosting, Canada is also a founding member of the High Ambition Coalition to End Plastic Pollution. 65 countries that want to end plastic pollution by 2040. Environment Minister Stephen Gilbo.
We won't ban our way out of plastic pollution. We won't recycle our way out of plastic pollution. And we won't reuse our way out of plastic pollution. We need to do a bit of all of these things at different...
There's steps. A lot of debate about just how far to go. Some, like Marian Ledesma from the Philippines, want dramatic cutbacks. In essence, a cap on plastics.
Greenpeace is calling for a cut in production of 75% by 2040. If we were to just have one single obligation there, it would be a cut in plastic production. And that would solve so many problems. If you're turning off the tap, you won't have to deal with the negative impacts down the line.
How much pushback is there to an idea like that?
Oh, there's definitely a lot of questions, and like particularly in states that are producing oil or other fossil fuels, they see this as a limitation in their progress and development. But this is what's necessary for the planet. And what we're proposing is that there will be a phase down. So it's not going to be immediate. There will be transition periods at the same time as countries have to justly transition to the alternatives, which we're proposing are reuse and refill systems. And these systems and models will provide jobs. They'll also provide socioeconomic benefits for communities. And what's great about them is that they're spreading the benefits around to all the different kinds of stakeholders. So obviously you're going to get these blockers that we call them saying that that's impossible. But the reality is we have to make it possible to make sure that we are achieving the best possible outcome.
To get a better sense of just how hard it will be to reconcile all of the different hopes for this summit, I sat down with the woman at the top. Inger Andersen is an Undersecretary General of the United Nations and Executive Director of the UN Environment Program. I started by asking her what's at stake in these talks.
So if we take a walk in any place, most places in the world, along the beach, along a waterway, at a drain, along a roadway, chances are that we're not going to see flowers or seaweeds. Chances are we'll find more plastic than we care to see. The truth is that plastic is going into our environment at an expeditious pace. We are producing about 430 million tons of this stuff every year, and only a very, very small fraction of that is recycled, around 7 to 9%. And the rest goes into landfills in the global north or into wild dump sites in the global south. The rains come and they carry whatever they will carry into drains, waterways, rivers, and the ocean. And so obviously no one is in favor of plastic in the environment, which is why we got that agreement to start this process, because everyone wants to end this scourge.
You say everyone wants to end it, but it is also, as you say, omnipresent, and you're trying to get the world to agree to certain conditions. How difficult, how challenging are these negotiations?
I mean, it's obviously challenging. The thing is, and maybe Canadian knows this more than most, this is not the first time that we are doing a big treaty negotiation, a very successful treaty that is actually got its name after Montreal, is the treaty that deals with chlorinated gases. The gases that we used to use to refrigerate and to cool things, for our air conditioners, fire foams, etc., fire retardants. And those gases were depleting our ozone layer. That was not a very good thing because we'd all get skin cancer and we'll see runaway global warming. So we decided, and from our hairspray cans and whatever else we had in the 60s, 70s, etc. And so we decided that we were going to just exit these gases. And lo and behold, 99% of all these gases are now exited from the production. And we now still have cold food in our refrigerators, still have air conditioning that works because we innovated our way out of this. So on the plastic side then, what is it that we need to do? There are things that we are producing that we all know is completely unnecessary. It's single use, it's problematic, and we use it for 5 minutes and then 1,000 years in the landfill. I mean, that makes no sense. So eliminating that which is single use and short-lived is clearly what we have to do. And that's certainly one of the things that will be significantly change. Another thing, and older folks will remember this because there was a time when our cleaning product and even our cosmetic and personal hygiene products were dry. We didn't have to deliver them wet. Today, a pump with a soap, well, it wasn't always like that. The bars of soap, soap powder, it seemed to have worked fairly well. And there is a lot of R&D going on where these products are now being delivered, not in the old way, but in a dry form, but in a more convenient to the household form.
Listening to you, you make it sound easy. And it's so much more complicated than that, is it not?
Yes and no, because the solutions are not that hard. Now, we're still going to need plastic for lighter vehicles, airplanes, boats and shipping, windmills and engines, I'm sure, electrical appliances and buildings. So this is not sort of stop all plastic production, but it is most definitely stop the unnecessary, the plastic that ends up the environment. Rethink everything. Go for refill options. Go for pump options in the stores, especially in the global south where people buy smaller quantities for because they don't have so much money. You don't need to buy that sachet with a metal lining for your soap, but actually you need to think about how you can just have refill instead. Now, the bigger issue is, of course, that there are economic interests and there's commercial interests. And so how do we make that alignment? In countries that are already beginning to make these alignments, the truth is that the private sector just follows. And what is so exciting is that the global consumer goods industry, did you see here on the streets of Ottawa, they have a van rolling around saying, we want rules. Because a global industry, they don't want to have their product bobbing up and down in the ocean. It detracts from their shareholder value. It detracts from worker pride. And it detracts, obviously, from investors' confidence.
And yet we hear that there are countries that are big producers of oil, right? Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, that are pushing back against some of the ideas that, for instance, this might be, the conditions eventually agreed upon might be binding.
Oh, the conditions will be binding, that's for sure. I mean, otherwise you can't have a global deal. The conditions are yet to be decided what they are. But when we went into this process, it is to have legally binding and non-legally binding elements. Capacity building, technical support is probably not legally binding, but is public awareness. You know, there are elements that are legally binding. But if we say, back to Montreal Protocol, that this gas will be phased out by time X, we're phasing it out. That's what we did. So environmental treaties need to have elements that, yes, we're all doing this and we're doing it at the same time, given a degree of differentiation between the very poorest and those that can move faster, etc. But yes. Now, we managed to get a unanimous decision of the entire 193 member states back in 2022 that it would have legally binding elements and that it would be the entire life cycle of plastic, which means from beginning to end. We're not backing down on that, so that's certainly the way that we're going.
What about this idea of a production cap, of limiting the amount of plastic that the world can produce? Is that a viable option?
So I think that we need to think this through, because as we look at an urbanizing population, as we look at, you know, 8 billion and counting, who are moving into apartments that we are building up, who need insulation, who will need to have structures, we will want to have net zero vehicles, lighter and more fuel efficient planes, trains and shipping. There we will need this material called plastic. So we need to be careful about capping things without understanding what other things we're going to need. However, we surely will need to see a reduction in the production of raw polymer that is being used for single-use, short-lived, and problematic. That's where the reduction needs to be, right? Because that's the problem. That's what is on our beaches and so on. We also need to talk about the chemicals that we put in the plastics, chemicals of concern. We know that there are chemicals that interfere with our fertility, that interfere with taking a child to full term, that can be cancer-causing. Surely, surely, we do not want these close to our bodies and our food. And these are the kind of things that we can also take global agreements on. All the more importantly, because we're going to have recycling of that which we must produce for whatever reason. And if that has to be recycled, we do not want these chemical traces in that which is recycled.
Thank you very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Inger Andersen is the executive director of the UN Environment Program. So what does all of this mean for the people who are actually selling us so much plastic? Alan Langdon is CEO of Circular Materials, a group founded by companies like Loblaws, Nestle, and McDonald's to work on closing the loop on recycling across Canada. I asked him whether Canada's goal of ending global plastic pollution by 2040 is realistic.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that it's definitely a possibility, right? What I've learned for this last 4 days sitting in these meetings is just the extent and the scope of who's involved, like global companies, global organizations, a range of different partners that have all come to understand that, okay, the collective action's needed. And now it's starting to look at, like, where do we need to target the money? Where do we need to target the investment? Where do we need to target this action? So I think that we're on the path now, and I think the next 5 years, particularly for some of these less developed countries, will be critical. But if they can make some of the progress over the next 5 years to address areas, particularly in the hotspots we see in Asia, South America, and Africa, then I think it's possible we could get to that goal in 2040.
But when it comes to Canada, what are producers here trying to do to get rid of plastic waste? Ellie Brown is the Director of Corporate Sustainability for the Sobeys grocery chain.
Yeah, we at Sobeys, you know, we acknowledge and also accept the responsibility that we have to help address the problem of plastic pollution. And we know that we have an impact, right? There are plastics that are used throughout a grocery store. I think a couple of things to keep in mind. A lot of that plastics obviously is to provide a container to carry the food that you have. And a lot of that is also necessary to help prevent food waste at the same time, because we don't want to waste food while we're also trying to reduce plastic pollution. So I think it's really about understanding what types of packaging can we have that still meets the needs of needing packaging, but allows us to reduce, reuse, and recycle as much as possible, which is the approach that we're aiming to take.
We're hearing that this is a major time of shift for producers, for industry. If I ask you what I might see when I walk into a grocery store 10 years from now, I mean, what do you picture? Where do you see all of this going?
For us at Sobeys, we are really focused on how do we impact the buying, the shopping, and the innovation towards a plastic waste-free future. One of the major initiatives that we did over the last few years is to remove single-use plastic grocery bags. And that action removed 800 million single-use plastic bags from circulation every year. And so one of the first things is, how do we do more of moving, transitioning from single-use plastics, especially unrecyclable single-use plastics, towards reusability as much as possible? So those are one of the things that we aim to see more of in our grocery stores. We're working with select peers and a technology partner to trial a reusable container program, and specifically our Farm Boy stores are going to be part of the program design of this program. And we're testing it in the hot food area of the store, where people can come in and, you know, serve themselves, the self-serve hot food area. And that's one area that we think is a great opportunity for us to test a reuse model with a reusable container that someone can come, use, and use again. And, you know, there's a number of challenges that we need to go through and sort of a number of steps that we need to take to really understand customer conversion towards a reuse in a reusable container setting. And that's why we're piloting, we're learning, and then we're going to see the opportunity to scale.
Alan Langdon of the industry-funded group Circular Materials sees big changes ahead.
Ultimately, what we're on the precipice of is this huge shift in how recycling is going to be run. And it's going to not only be a better system, but a system operated and funded by the people who are making the packaging.
That system is known as extended producer responsibility. Provinces across the country are making the shift. It means industry becomes responsible for the packaging of the products they sell, including taking over recycling programs previously run by municipalities. Right now, only about 9% of plastic waste in Canada gets recycled. I asked Langdon if Canada needs to pull up its socks on the recycling front.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what I'm used to talking about. But we're also, you know, what we're looking at right now is how do we take, you know, a really fragmented system that's run differently in each individual municipality across Canada and turn it into one consistent system so that residents going forward, it'll have the same material list in every community across the country. We'll know what to put in their blue box. We'll have consistent education programs across the country that leverage that consistent material list. So again, it's simpler and simpler. And we can start to use that also as a kind of feedback mechanism for producers to say, you know, as you're looking at designing packaging, there's a conversation that could be had between the system operator and the producer. Is that packaging going to make it in the system? Do we need to make changes to the packaging? Or is it that we need to change the system? Because once we have a uniform system, it might be that we can change the system to allow that package to be recycled. But I think what we're going to see over the next 3 years is a system where we're going to see almost every package in the country being able to be put in your blue box, and then we'll develop pathways to make sure that that material can not only be recycled, but eventually returned to the producers.
I appreciate that this is really multifaceted, but if you had to identify for the average Canadian what the hardest part is for plastics producers in trying to eliminate plastic pollution, what's the biggest challenge?
Well, this is my challenge. The challenge we have right now is that right now we cannot recycle all the plastics put in the market. And so I think two things need to change. One is we need to adapt the system. The system across Canada is mostly using outdated infrastructure, and we need to renew and build new infrastructure over the next 5 years. I also think now that once we have that consistent system across the country, we can really work with producers to make improvements to packaging so that all that packaging can actually be recycled and not just recycled, but actually delivered right back to producers so it can be inserted into their supply chain and come out as recycled content and new packaging.
But Rufino Varia, the scientist from Fiji, is skeptical of all this talk of recycling.
Recycling is a band-aid solution if you're looking at it from a scientific but also from an economical perspective. Recycling is not economical, and many industries that are pushing for it don't actually engage in recycling because it's too expensive. The reason why I say it is a band-aid solution is because when we look at a life cycle approach, plastics has an end of life. Even for products that are recyclable, it has an end of life. In the Pacific, we have a linear economy, not a circular economy, meaning that we do not produce plastics, we import them, they're used, they become waste. It's linear. For a circular economy, again, it does not make any sense logically where recycling fits into that model, because less than 20% of recyclable products are ever recycled. And those that do make it through can only be recycled only once or so. So again, for now, in terms of managing waste, it is helping ease the burden a bit for countries with linear economies. But to push it as a strong agenda in the argument of having it within a circular economy model, it is, I would say, a false solution.
So where does all of this leave the negotiations? Among the people packed into this downtown convention center in Ottawa, I meet two consultants who specialize in recycling and the circular economy, Dominic Hogg and Clarissa Morosky.
Hi, I'm Catherine. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Is this like kind of an exciting thing for you guys or meh?
You know, it is exciting, but at the end of the day, whatever this treaty comes up with, it'll only be as good as how the member nations, the parties to the agreement, actually implement it. And it'll be an interesting thing to see whether there's anything in the treaty which each of those parties couldn't actually do today anyway.
Can I ask you, Clarissa, what for you is the most, like the key part of what's going on here?
Well, we know there's a lot of support for extended producer responsibility. That seems to be what everybody is talking about. So we think that that is definitely going to be in the treaty. Devil's in the details. We have to make sure that it's properly written so that the money is actually financing the collection of litter, proper treatment, logistics, the whole kit and caboodle of all of the generated waste. The reality is that 67% of the global population do not have access to waste collection services. And that's the fundamental reason why we have a plastics pollution problem. So the first thing we need to do is get everybody around the world up to that 95% coverage level. To me, that is the number one priority. Everything else is really important, but we have to get everybody up to that basic level.
I want to talk about plastic straws, because I think
I ask about the argument made by some conservative MPs that it's no good to replace a plastic straw with a paper straw that could be lined with chemicals that pose a risk to human health, or replace single-use plastic bags with reusable bags that just pile up in people's closets and don't actually get reused.
Well, I mean, I think that we've grown up in the last 20 years to we're a single-use society. This is how we do things, and it's going to take a lot to get out of that. I think that we are starting to see some interesting things like deposit return programs, not here in Ontario, but in the rest of Canada. They work very well. European Union just this morning voted in favor of the most aggressive packaging regulation. It is mandatory deposit return for 500 million people. So we're going to start to see people think twice about single-use items because they're going to have a value and they're going to think twice about throwing them away.
The talks in Canada will wrap up Monday. In November, everyone will return to the negotiating table in South Korea for one last effort. For some, every day without stronger action on plastic pollution has consequences. Marian Ledesma of Greenpeace Philippines.
I went to one of, basically, so like a nature reserve near the capital. It's called Freedom Island. And we've done so many coastal cleanups there. We did a documentation last October, and then we were asking people who were doing cleanups and also waste pickers in the area, when did you last clean it? Because we were walking down the beaches and they were completely covered in trash. And they said, oh, we were doing this yesterday too. And just to see how much waste there was, it's constantly filling up. And that tells you how much of a problem it is. And at the same time, how much we need to address the problem at source or at root, because the waste keeps on coming. If we don't reduce plastic production, it will just continuously overwhelm our waste management systems. No matter how good it is, there's always going to be that influx of plastics if we keep producing it.
Before we go, it's time for some feedback. 2 weeks ago, we reported on the housing measures in the federal budget, and we visited some apprentice bricklayers. Here's one thing masonry instructor Dave Mulcahy told me.
I don't know if anyone's figured out why young people don't want to do this type of work or don't want to get into the trades. There has to be a reason.
Well, our senior producer Jennifer Chevalier is here with some of your reaction to that.
Well, Cynthia Gordon might have an answer for Dave. She works with unemployed youth in Simcoe County in Ontario. She wrote, "Work in the trades is one of the top job goals young people have when they meet with her. Sadly, many become discouraged because first-year apprenticeship positions are very scarce. Getting started in the trades has huge barriers," she writes, "and many can't afford an extended job search to eventually be taken on as an apprentice." And carpenter Kai Vandermeer in Halifax also contacted us about what Dave said. Here's his take.
There are almost no job protection. You can be laid off whenever your employer wants, and you have no legal recourse. You have no sick days, you have no benefits, you have no family days, and bad weather means no pay. As a young person trying to raise a young family, that's a pretty daunting scenario. If I need to suddenly leave to get my daughter from school, I don't get paid. Perhaps if the housing minister really wants to encourage the trades with younger Canadians, they might consider altering the labor conditions.
There's a lot to think about there. Thank you for this, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
Let us know what you think about what you heard on the show this week. Our email address is thehouse@cbc.ca. That is it from us, though, for this week. Our team on The House is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Christian Posling, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. A special thanks this week to our intern, Samira Ayat Kasi Ali. I'm Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.